Mr. Faulkner will read a wonderful passage from his new novel, The Town, this afternoon, and thereafter answer any questions from the floor. You may be interested to know that your opinion of the temperature of this room as time goes on is shared by the writer in residence, who calls it the black hole, but you might feel reassured if I remind you that this is not merely the only room in the university that fits exactly the acoustics of Mr. Faulkner's voice, but it's partly our contribution to acclimatizing him for his return to a Mississippi summer. For he must return, he says, after one of the most exciting terms for us, and in valedictory, one is tempted to point with local pride now to Mr. Faulkner along with Messrs. Jefferson and Poe. He has spent almost as much time at the university as Poe did. His his work, like that of Poe, which seemed Gothic at one time to many readers, turns out to be not of Germany, but of the soul, as Poe said himself. And he has proven himself a gentleman not only of Mississippi or of Virginia, but like Thomas Jefferson, of the world. And possibly this afternoon our response may help to induce him to return next year. This return would be that of the most distinguished writer of fiction in the world today, Mr. William Faulkner.
I reckon the only way I can live up to that encomium is by going back to Mississippi right away. There's a ridge. You drive on beyond Seminary Hill, and in time you come upon it. A mild, unhurried farm road presently mounting to cross the ridge and on to join the main highway leading from Jefferson to the world. And now, looking back and down, you see all your Potawatomi in the dying last day beneath you. There are stars now, just pricking out as you watch them among the others already cold and softly burning. The end of day is one vast, green, soundless murmur up the northwest toward the zenith. Yet it is as though light were not being subtracted from earth, drained from earth backward and upward into that cooling green, but rather had gathered, cooling for an unmoving moment yet, among the low places of the ground, so that ground, earth itself, is luminous, and only the dense clumps of trees are dark, standing darkly and immobile out of it. Then, as though it signaled the fireflies, lightning bugs of the Mississippi child's vernacular, myriad and frenetic, random and frantic, pulsing, not questing, not quarrying, but quarrying, as if they were tiny, incessant, appeaseless voices, cries, words. And you stand, suzerain and solitary, above the whole sum of your life, beneath that incessant, ephemeral scrambling. First is Jefferson, the center, radiating weakly its puny glow into space. Beyond it, enclosing it, spreads the county. Tied by the diverging roads to that center, as is the rim to the hub by its spokes, yourself detached as God himself for this moment above the cradle of your nativity and of the men and women who made you. The record and chronicle of your native land proper for your perusal and ringed by concentric ring like a ripple on living water above the dreamless slumber of your past. You to preside, unanguished and immune, above this miniature of man's passions and hopes and disasters, ambition and fear and lust and courage and abnegation and pity and honor and sin and pride, all bound, precarious, and ramshackle, held together by the web, the iron-thin warping woof of his rapacity, but withal yet dedicated to his dreams. They are all here, supine beneath you, stratified and superposed, osseous and durable, with the frail dust and the phantom, the rich alluvial river bottom lands of old Ishitibihar, the wild Chickasaw king, with his negro slaves and his sister's son called Doom, who murdered his way to the throne, and legend said, record itself said, since there were old men in the county in my own childhood who had actually seen it, stole an entire steamboat and had it dragged intact 11 miles overland to convert into a palace proper to aggrandize his state. The same fat, black, rich plantation earth, still synonymous with the proud, fading white plantation names, whether we, I mean of course they, ever actually owned plantation or not, Sutphin and Sardis and Compson, and Edmonds and McCaslin and Beecham and Grenier and Habersham, and Holston and Stevens and Despain, generals and governors and judges, soldiers, even if only Cuban lieutenants, and statesmen failed not, and simple politicians, and overreachers, and just simple favors, who snatched and grabbed and passed and vanished, name and face and all. Then the roadless, almost pathless, perpendicular hill country of McCallum and Gowrie and Frazier and Muir, translated intact, with their pots stilled and still speaking only the old Gaelic and not much of that, from Culloden to Carolina, then from Carolina to Yucatan, still intact and still not speaking much of anything, except that now they call the pots kettles, though the drink, even I can remember this, was still usquebaugh. Then and last on to where Frenchman Ben lay beyond the southeastern horizon, cradle of bomb as an ant heap of the northeast crawl of Snopes. And you stand there, you, the old man, already white-headed, because it doesn't matter if they call your gray hairs premature, because life itself is always premature, which is why it aches and anguishes, and pushing 40, only a few years from 40, while there rises up to you, proffered up to you, the spring darkness, the unsleeping darkness which, although it is of dark itself, declines the dark, since dark is only that called sleeping. Because look how, even though the last of west is no longer green, all the firmament is now an unlidded, studded, sobering awe, and the last of earth's cool visibility has drained away, there still remains one faint diffusion. Since everywhere you look above the dark panorama, you still see them, faint as whispers, the faint and shapeless lament of blooming dogwood, returning lone light to light, as the phantoms of candles. And you, the old man, standing there while there rises to you, about you, suffocating you, the spring dark people in myriad, two and two, seeking never at all solitude, but simply privacy, the privacy decreed and created for them by the spring dark, the spring lover, the spring which an American poet, a fine one, a woman, and so she knows, called girls' love and boys' love, which was not the first day at all, not even morning at all, because girls' love and boys' love is the sum of all the days. The bowl proffered once to the lips in youth and then no more, proffered to quench a sip of rain that long one time and even then that sometimes premature too soon, because the tragedy of life is it must be premature, inconclusive and inconcludable in order to be life. It must be before itself, in advance of itself, to have been at all.
To answer questions on many subjects, and I'm sure he will entertain them now.
Not consent, but anxious to do. Anybody likes to stand up in front of a lot of nice people and talk, and nobody can say, shut up and sit down. Transcribe it onto paper, to shape it. And he, I think, is trying to tell the whole passion of man's condition, his hopes, his fears, his aspirations, in the short time he has to live before he dies. And so, by instinct, if he don't watch himself, he tries to put everything into one long sentence. Like the man that used to inscribe all of the Lord's Prayer on the head of the pen, that he must do it while he has breath to do it in. Yes, sir. The pressure is not actually from the publisher. When I first thought of these people and the idea of a tribe of people that, which would come into an otherwise peaceful little southern town like ants or like mold on cheese, then I discovered then that to tell the story properly would be too many words to compress into one volume. It had to be two or three. So the pressure has been on me before I ever told the publisher about it, that I would have to keep on writing about these people until I got it all told. And I assume that one more book will do it, though I don't have any great hopes that it will. Also, by nature, I'm completely disorderly. I never have learned to hang up anything or put anything back where I got it. And so I work as the athlete says, when I'm hot. And I don't like to work. I'm by nature lazy. I will put it off as long as I can. Then when I get started, it's fun. I think the reason anyone writes is because it's fun. You like it. That's just your cup of tea. And so I will write until I have to make myself stop, because I've found that the only rule for writing I have is to leave it while I'm still hot, while I'm still looking good, as gentlemen prefer blondes put it, so that I can take up again tomorrow. But I've never had any order. Some people are orderly. They lay out a plot, a synopsis first. They make notes, which is valid and satisfactory for them, but not for me. I would be completely lost. Probably if I were going to make a few notes, I could say, oh, well, that's all. You don't need to work anymore, and I'd quit. So I think I put off working as long as possible and do as much of the research and the note filing up here, and then begin to write. Yes, sir, I write it out in longhand because I never have learned to think good onto the typewriter. That I've got to feel the pencil and see the words at the end of the pencil, then if the wrong word is simple enough to scratch it out and try it again. I reckon I was started writing too soon to have taken the typewriter as an extension of the hands as the young man nowadays can do. I have to put it down on paper first. After that, I do the rewriting on the typewriter, but something has got to be on paper first for me to look at and get the feel of. So fast that somebody said my handwriting looks like a caterpillar that crawled through an inkwell and out onto a piece of paper. If I leave it until tomorrow, I can't read it myself, so it's got to be put on quick and then type quick. His aim is to show people, human beings, in the human condition, faced with the tragedies, the aspirations, the hopes, which all people are faced with, in the most moving way he can. If his outlook is pessimistic, it's simply because that is not his intention to be pessimistic. It's because having watched people in their confusion and their aspirations that are what are. What he gets is an immediate feeling of pessimism, though the very fact that he keeps on trying to write about people implies that he has some hope for man, that he sees man as trying to do better than he does, to be more honest than he is, to be braver. That the pessimism is a matter of the moment. Maybe the writer does want to do his bit toward making man better. Maybe he thinks if he shows man in his moments of baseness, it may be a lesson to someone, either don't do this, or a reminder even when people do this, at other times they do good things, fine things, that they will do things that other people shan't suffer. Yes.
You always know how the question will come up before you start writing.
No, sir, I don't. The trick is to get the characters and work at them until they stand on their own feet and take three dimensions and cast a shadow and begin to move. After that, all the writer has to do is to run along behind them with a notebook and put down what they say and do. That he himself, or I anyway, don't know where they go. All I know is that they're alive and they're in motion, and if I can keep up and write fast enough, I won't miss anything. Only the point that they are alive and that the reader will believe that they are alive. They may do things that shock him and outrage him and that he doesn't like, but my hope is he'll say, well, they are alive anyway. They are scoundrels and rascals, but they are alive. That is the hope I think that any writer has, that the people he creates are credible. That the comedy, the tragedy they run into, the silly things they do are things that are within the scope of the human being to do. That book began as so many books do with an anecdote, a picture. The picture was of those children who had been sent from the house. They didn't know why. Something was taking place in the house in the fall. And like children, they were curious to know what it was. And the only one that was brave enough to climb the tree was the little girl. And the book grew from that. It started off to be a simple short story. I wrote the first section, which was the idiot brothers. I realized that that wasn't enough. I hadn't told that story. So I let another brother try to tell that the second section. I realized that still wasn't enough. I hadn't told that story. So I let the second brother try, which was the third section. That still wasn't enough. So then I had Fatman try. And it still is not enough. I still haven't told that story to suit me. That's the reason. That to me is the one I love the dearest, that I'm the most fond of, because that was the most splendid favorite. And I still haven't told that story. I believe that if I had to do over, I could do it better. Of course, I wouldn't. But that's the one book I wish I hadn't written so I could write it now. Yes, sir. That's right. I think that's true of any writer. That's why he writes another book. If he wrote the book that pleased him absolutely, that was perfect by his own standards, then nothing remains but to cut the book. But that book failed, so he writes another. He believes that the next one won't fail. Of course it will, which is good for him because that keeps him working. And I think that no life is as happy as our life in which you try to make something which wasn't here before, a picture or a symphony or a book or a piece of sculpture. And that is, to me, the best life of all, not a happy life, because it's filled with anger, frustration, because it's not perfect, of rage and exhaustion, but it's really a matchless life. I wouldn't put any occupation above. I think that a man that can young woman who can dedicate himself or herself to that simple idea, to make something which didn't exist before, is the best life. Yes, sir.
Can I ask how much your daily variation of mood affects the action of your character? Suppose one day you get up feeling fine, do your character tend to take on a cheerful aspect?
I don't believe so. I think that anyone, the painter, the musician, the writer, wakes in a kind of an insane fury. He's demon-driven. He can get up feeling rotten with a hangover or with actual pain, and if he gets to wake, the first thing he knows, he don't remember that pain, that hangover. He's too busy. That his feeling, I doubt if that reflects too much in his work. That he can wake up and go to work feeling good, and the first thing he knows, he doesn't remember whether he feels good or not. He's too busy. That he is in the clutch of a demon there. Yes, ma'am.
Would that mean that he also
proclivious
to atmosphere?
No, I think the writer, any artist, is completely amoral. He robs and steals everywhere he can find anything he might need. The atmosphere he has gathered up from observation, from experience, just from living and breathing. He stows that away, and then when he needs it to put into what he writes, he hunts around in his trash bin or his lumber room and picks out the atmosphere or the symbolism or the style, whatever he needs. But he has acquired that long before he sits down to write. At the time he's writing, he's like the carpenter building a fence or a chicken coop. He's busy sawing planks and driving nails. That he has already got his supply of nails and his boards at hand, where he can reach back into his workshop and get what plank or what size nails he needs. As far as I know, they do, because the friends I have are not literary friends. They are people engaged in other pursuits, and unless I'm as good in their pursuits as they are, they have, of course, a low opinion of me. If I'm as good in their pursuits, that is, farming or hunting or with horses as they are, then they have a high opinion of me, which has nothing to do with my book, because they don't read my book. Someone has said that nobody in Mississippi reads, they're all right. Was for the sake of that child. She at that time had realized that every child, or young girl especially, needed the semblance of an intact home, that is, to have a mother and a father, to have the same things that the other children had. And she had reached an impasse where her lover would have demanded that she leave her husband. And then that child would have found out that it had grown up in a broken home. Up to this time, whether the child loved Flem or not, at least he was a symbol of the father which all the other children had. And would the mother felt it'd be better for this girl to have had a mother who committed suicide than a mother who ran off with a lover, which was That may have been the wrong decision she made, but that was the decision she did make. That at least this girl would have had the similitude of an intact, though tragedy-ridden home, just as other children did.
By chance, had in mind about the story of his daughter now?
Yes, so that will be in the next book. She's one of the most interesting people I've written about yet, I think. Her story will be in the next book. Yes, ma'am. Not deliberately. The symbolism is a part of anyone's past. I mean by that his environment, his background, his experience, his observation. And a part of that background is the Christian religion. The writer is engaged primarily in writing about people. He's doing this in the most moving and most effective way he knows. And the symbolism, like the style, they are the nails and the boards in the carpenter's workshop. And these symbols appear almost by coincidence in what he does. He is simply writing out of his own background of observation and experience, that he hasn't got time to say, now I'm going to use a symbol. He's too busy writing about simple men and women engaged in the tragedy of man's condition, engaged in the conflict with the human heart or with its fellows or with its environment, its background. And I think that the reader must read any book from the same background which the writer writes it from, that is, from the background of observation, experience, and imagination. And so the reader reads into the book, finds in the book symbolism which the writer didn't know was there and is not really interested in finding there. He was too busy. But he doesn't doubt that the symbolism is there. Or even if it were not, what symbolism is there could be translated into someone else's understanding and comprehension. That is, a Chinese could probably find Chinese symbolism in an American book, just as the American can find American symbolism in a Chinese or Japanese book. Yes. I would like to think that some do. The advice was simply that no law or edict passed by no matter whom is going to change a social condition until the people involved in that condition wish it changed. That is, if the Negro were given equality by police force, he would keep that equality only as long as the police stood there. When the police were gone, then someone smarter or more ruthless would take it away from him again. That he has got to earn that equality. He has got to learn, as everybody must, that liberty and freedom is not a condition like rainfall or sunshine or being too cold or being too hot. That's a condition that one must work to gain and then work to hold. That to keep equality and freedom, you must learn the responsibility of equality and freedom. That nobody can have the freedom given him by the police until he's willing to deserve it and then work to keep it, which is to be responsible for it. And I do hope that some people in the nigger race read it and believe in it and will take heed to it, since it's a problem which has got to be solved, as we can't deport the whole nigger race. He's a part of our country now, and we must, all the white man and the nigger too, must work together to make his condition bearable. Otherwise, it's like having 17 million mules running loose in the country. Yes, ma'am. position. It's the whole white race, the white economy, has placed him in an inferior position economically and educationally, because in that position, the white man's revenues from his economy would be a little higher. It's not that the nigger, we don't know whether the nigger's inferior to the white man or not. He's had no chance to be anything else. But as I see it, he must have the chance to prove whether he is inferior or not. That he is not going to be content any longer to be inferior. I mean, artificially inferior. He's got to have the chance to prove that if he is equal or incapable of it. And it's better for the white man to give him that chance than to have that chance foisted on the white man by law. Well, sir, I would say by custom, and then of course all law is it speaks after the fact. The law simply makes legal what has been accustomed. The law don't check.